You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design spicy new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, the latest developments from SCG Columbus and the Modern Playoffs, plus preview cards from Theros Beyond Death. After that, it is time for our first edition of the Brew Review, featuring the spiciest decks submitted by our listeners in Modern and Pioneer. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 37 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, wishing everybody a happy new year. Hopefully everyone had a safe and happy time ushering in 2020. I am joined, as always, by my guy on the left coast. He is Nuke Launch Online. He has survived his sojourn to Mexico. Mr. Damon Alexander, what's going on?
Hey, yeah, I had a great trip. Feliz Año Nuevo to yourself. Just got back, rocking a little bit of a tan in this Seattle weather. It'll last all of maybe 24 hours before I'm back to being pale again, but it was great to get a little bit of sunshine.
That's exciting. Joining us, as always, is the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Cave Dan Online. Dan Schriever, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, I'm surviving. I was also traveling a lot this week, but for me, that just meant driving up and down the Northeast Corridor in the rain, so a little bit less exciting than Damon's Mexico trip.
How's your tan?
Well, we can see each other on video, and Damon, I don't know if it's the lighting, but I'm trying to imagine the tan. It's all right. Yeah, it's not bad. Not bad for a short trip.
The tan is all the friends we made along the way.
Those don't fade.
So before we get into the latest comings and goings of the Magic world, we want to give a quick shout out to our two newest patrons, Raphael R. and Kian. Thank you very much for hopping aboard and welcome to the Faithless Brewing Patreon. Also, we want to give a shout out to Unpronounceable, who has increased their pledge. We appreciate it very much, and we look forward to creating a bunch of great content in 2020.
Yeah, and if anyone's interested in throwing us some support, patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is the place. We have a bunch of different tiers you can check out, different benefits. You get Discord access. You can come chat with us throughout the week. And every once in a while, we have an episode where you can chime in and help us pick a topic for the card, or like this show, where you can send in your deck list and have us talk about it on air.
Definitely. So we had our last weekly Pioneer announcement. There were no bans, but over the course of the weekend, there was quite a bit of action in Modern. Dan, I know you kind of had your eye on this. Is there anything that really stuck out to you?
Yeah, so over the weekend, there were two big tournaments. One was a Star City Games Team Open, SCG Columbus, where all three players were playing Modern, and that was not Unified Modern. You could register the same deck three times if you like. The other tournament was much smaller, more intimate. This was the Magic Online Modern Championship, kind of a high-stakes invitational event. The only way to qualify for that tournament was to finish in the top eight of one of the Modern playoffs throughout the year, so I think there were only maybe 40 players in that field, but they were all Magic Online grinders and sort of the top players on that platform. Going through the lists, we got, I think, all the Day 2 lists from the SCG, as well as all the lists from the Modern Championship, really painted a different picture. SCG was almost all Urza and Amulets, whereas the Modern Champ was quite a diverse field. I think the Urza deck still performed the best at the end of all that, and when you crunch the numbers, Oko was still in, I don't know, maybe half of those decks. But it seems like, we've talked about this at length before, that the Star City Circuit is somewhat inbred, perhaps by nature of being a tour. People are not as willing to take risks, and then the fact that it's a team event maybe lends itself to that dynamic as well, where you saw a lot of the same decks getting registered.
Yeah, if anything, Dan, actually, I felt the Modern Format Championship was a more narrow metagame compared to the normal MTGO challenges. The challenges seem to be mostly dominated by Simic, Urza, e-tron, and Shadow, but the challenges typically have maybe like half the top 32 comprised of those lists, and then half of it are other lists. The Format Championship looked to be more being just those top decks.
In terms of innovations in the top strategies, here are some of the things I found. So in Amulet Titan, which was in the second place team at SCG Columbus, both Matt Deluxe and Will Pulliam, noted Amulet players, they had gone back to four copies of Explorer in their list. Kind of ancient tech. I think Explorer had been discarded a year ago or something, and people just sort of stopped talking about it while trying out other stuff like Trinket Mage or whatever else, most recently Splashing Oko. It was interesting to see both those players arrive at a list that was just back to Explorers, I think possibly influenced by some of the lessons from this Simic Field of the Dead deck that had been making the rounds. People are realizing you're just making extra land plays is better than it was before, now that Field of the Dead is in the fold. On the Urza side of things, Urza continued to be the kind of deck where you can have the same core and just change 5 to 6 cards and call it a brew. So where we're at right now is that Teemer Urza is sort of the new tech. Teemer meaning it's the regular Urza deck, splashing for a Galvanic Blast and Experimental Frenzy. Galvanic Blast makes sense. It can pick off an opposing Urza, it can kill a card in the Great Creator, which is sometimes a problematic card. Frenzy is one that I was not expecting to see in this shell, but I think the card is just amazing if you can get away with it.
I think it's important to note that Experimental Frenzy is an enchantment, so it is uniquely resistant to Oko's +1 ability.
Yes.
Not accidental that many of the cards that we brewed around as Oko began to take over Modern were also enchantments or creatures where we did not care about the text on the card.
Somehow enchantment has become the safest card type in the Oko metagame. You'll see things like Choke is a card that people are suddenly very interested in because it actually does a little bit against Urza and they can't easily remove it. Blood Moon has made a mini comeback, although that's bad against Urza, but decent against Field. For me, a card like Suppression Field, I think, is really interesting. There's a ton of decks that get their advantage by just taking a bunch of game actions. If there was some way to build a deck with a bunch of Suppression Fields, I think you could do quite well with that in Modern. And yeah, Experimental Frenzy, oldie but goodie. Other developments, kind of the tale of 2019 in some ways. Eldrazi Tron has picked up Once Upon a Time, a light green splash. This is something that you asked about this a few weeks ago, Dave. Oh, has E-tron picked up Once Upon a Time? And I was like, oh, of course not. That's ridiculous. It's a colorless deck. You can't just splash Once Upon a Time. Well, okay. It turns out, once again, like the prophet Cassandra, you predict the future and no one believes you. For main deck, Veil of Summers and Titan Shift. Burn, trying to get leaner and meaner with Soul Scar Mage and Lava Dart, replacing the white cards, replacing the Lightning Helix Boros Charm, that kind of thing. So, in some sense, innovations, but in other sense, people just sort of realizing that the best things that you can do in Modern tend to be either the most efficient, brutally powerful, or the most rawly efficient. That was on display very much in these decks. There were a few specific lists that gave me some hope. One was our friend Lanny Huang, a longtime listener and longtime Niv player, managed to take his classic Niv-Mizzet with Utopia Sprawls to 7-0 in the Modern Challenge. So he was undefeated, first seed going into the top 8 before he was ultimately felled by Bogles of all things. Great job to Lanny on that result. Another Niv pilot, Brian Garia, also known as I Have the Fire Online, who came to prominence when he himself 12-0'd a Modern Challenge right after Faithless Legion was banned. And then the following week, he won a paper MCQ with Niv-Mizzet as well. He played in the Modern Champs and he went with a brew that had been doing even better for him, which was a Naya Stoneblade deck, but it's not really Stoneblade because the most exciting card he's getting there is Embercleave, so it's kind of a Naya Stonecleave. This is a kind of deck that when I saw it, I thought, you just can't play this kind of deck in Modern. I was shocked because it's just a bunch of value creatures. Tireless Trackers, some Stoneforge Mystics, some Ren and Sixes, Path to Exiles. To me, that kind of stuff just doesn't work in Modern as it currently stands, but I haven't been playing that deck, and he has. Maybe he's onto something here. Do you guys think there's anything to that kind of shell?
Dave, I know you were asking about the combination of Stoneforge Mystic with Embercleave.
Embercleave is a card that I've really liked in Pioneer, obviously a much weaker format, but getting to only play one, but being able to tutor for it is really attractive. One of the things that happens a lot when you want to play your 2 or 3 Embercleave to make sure you draw it in Pioneer is you get Embercleave flooded. It is legendary. It can only be cast if you've got a bunch of creatures in play, and I think what Dan is saying is, you know, that a lot of times you got a bunch of just garbage hanging around. You drew a bunch of extra birds, or you got a Knight of the Reliquary and something else, and all of a sudden you have a way to turn that into, hopefully, a winning position. I love to see the one of Elspeth, Knight Errant. I think this is a really powerful Planeswalker that people forget about. Unfortunately, the combat step just doesn't matter that much in Modern, unless it involves that combat step fetching up 2 lands of any kind from your deck and putting them into play tapped. I can't say if this deck is good or bad. My instincts are sort of like yours, Dan. We've gotten burned playing these types of decks a lot. I have, of course, on this podcast even said I'm not going to ever sleep off Knight of the Reliquary again unless I have a way to win the next turn. If you have enough lands in play, it actually could possibly kill somebody, I guess. I want this deck to be good, which makes me suspicious that it's probably not.
Yeah, I mean, I felt the same way, but I can't argue with results. And yeah, Brian was saying that he had been like crushing it with this deck, so much so that even while also doing well with Niv, he decided to keep Niv on the shelf and play this instead. And maybe I'm not doing a good job describing it because I immediately highlight the cards like Tireless Tracker that I think are kind of mopey, grindy, value cards. But maybe the key is, you know, Knight of the Reliquary can be huge. He's got three Questing Beast main. The key interaction being that Stoneforge Mystic can fetch Embercleave, put Embercleave into play for two, and it will still attach to the creature. So you can attach it to this Death Touch haste creature, and you'll have a nice little 10-10 Trample Death Touch Questing Beast. So this list gives me a little bit of hope. Two other lists that I thought were interesting. Another Knight of the Reliquary deck, believe it or not, somehow comes from Kazuga in the Modern Challenge. Basically the Primeval Titan ramp deck. Kazuga's innovation was basically just to add Knight of the Reliquary in the three slot instead of cards like Oko or Azusa or anything else like that. So is that crazy? The hypothesis here is that when you're in a land space, most of the deck is fixed, or you have 30 lands, you have your best ramp cards, Explore, Once Upon a Time, or Boreal Grazer, Secure Tribe Scout, whatever. You have your 8 Primeval Titans via Summoner's Pact and Primeval Titan, and then you have about 4 to 5 slots left over. Kazuga is using those slots on the Knight of the Reliquary, 1 Ramyotip Excavator, and 1 Tireless Tracker.
That seems a little crazy in a world that's dominated by Oko. Knight of the Reliquary just seems to be not a card that interacts well against that Planeswalker.
Yeah, either we're crazy or he's crazy, but he's got the results.
Yeah, I mean, I think the logic there is if you open on Sakura Tribe Scout and play Knight of the Reliquary on 2, then you can Titan on 3. Titan is one of the few cards that lines up reasonably well against Oko because it has a come into play ability that can go over the top. And in the mirror match, there's so little interaction that you'll get to Titan first because Titan has both a come into play and an attack ability. That puts you quite a bit ahead, actually. As a mirror tech breaker, that seems very powerful. And then on the play, at least, against Oko, it should give you some game, hopefully, is the thought process.
Right. There are enough lands now that tap for 2 mana, so Castle Garenbrig and then the Karu lands. So in this build, it would be the green-white ones, Celestine Sanctuary, that the ability to tutor for a specific land off Knight actually does speed you up in the same way that an Azusa might. It's just another land-adjacent 3-drop creature, and there's another one that was spoiled from Theros that we'll get to in a bit that is in contention now for this style of deck. The last build I want to mention is a Liquimetal Coating Urza deck. Liquimetal Coating, 2-mana artifact that taps to make any permanent into an artifact in addition to its other types until the end of the turn. When you have that in conjunction with Karn the Great Creator, anyone who's played against Karn the Great Creator long enough knows they will eventually start destroying your lands with this combination. It turns out you can also do that with Oko Thief of Crowns. Oko can turn their lands into elk with the help of Liquimetal Coating. So between 3 Karns and 4 Okos and 4 Coatings main, this is kind of adds a prison element to the Urza shell. This list showed up, I think, in the challenge. It was also piloted to a 6th place finish in the Star City Modern Classic by Phil England.
Yeah, I love this list. I tooled around a lot with Liquimetal Coating, and I think I had sent you a bunch of lists, Dan, but must have been right before Pioneer came out, where I was playing, yeah, like 3 or 4 Oko. I was playing main deck Knight of Autumn and 4 Karn, and then, yeah, the 4 Liquimetal Coating and 4 Ancient Stirrings to find the Coating and a couple Ancient Grudge, I think. And then I think I was playing Wall of Blossoms, maybe, to block all of the 3/3s that we're going to give them as we took away all their lands. So yeah, they welded that type of plan, but they welded it to the maybe most powerful creature in all of Modern, which is Urza himself. I'm not surprised that this deck did really well. The format has gotten way more narrow than Modern ever had. I mean, that was a problem we had with some of the Liquimetal lists that we tried the 1 week. It was great against certain decks, but against other decks, the Karn package doesn't do much. But now, if everyone's kind of on the same 3 or 4 lists, you know you're just going to have targets for your Ancient Grudge. It's not often going to be just a totally dead card.
Right. You can now register 4 Ancient Grudge main deck and feel pretty confident that they're going to be live. I guess that's kind of where we're at with Modern right now. Those are the lists that jumped out at me. Of course, there were a ton of lists overall. Anything else catch your eye's eye from these results over the weekend?
I've just been sort of fascinated. You know, it seemed like Oko was powerful in Modern, like one of the best things you could be doing, but not oppressive. And either because of people perfecting lists or the hive mind or whatever it is, it now seems to have become oppressive. 9 of the top 16 lists at the challenge were Oko lists, and as you say, a bit of an artifact of both SEG inbreeding and the nature of team tournaments, but Oko was everywhere. If you turned on the footage, you just watched Oko decks play against Oko decks. The gameplay pattern is not particularly pleasant to watch, I will say. I mean, there's lots of decisions, so I think in one sense, good players like playing with Oko. There's lots of things to be done, but it means that the games are going to go a long time, and there's going to be lots of game options, and most of your draws are blank because your creatures don't have text. So I'm not sure exactly what the proximal cause of this is, but all of a sudden it seems like Oko needs to be banned, and it didn't seem like it was even that powerful in Modern a month ago, and no new cards have been printed. So
I think that about a month ago it was starting to trend trend in the direction that felt like Oko would clearly be banned at some point. About a month ago, we're starting to see all these like Death Shadow lists start to go to the Sultai direction to play Oko. We saw the Infect list starting to play Oko, sometimes like main deck. We've been seeing decks sort of steadily contort themselves around Oko for a while now. It's kind of reached the point where it seems like overall the best ways to contort decks to play Oko just fall into these Urza decks and these Amulet decks and maybe a Snowblade deck. And then somehow Giftstorm apparently is like somehow competitive.
Well, I think they just want to just straight up race. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
If people are trying to Mystic Sanctuary for Cryptic Command, then you need to start doing stuff where four mana is on the table.
Yeah.
Damon, you predicted that Oko would not survive 2020, and I tend to agree, but because we're in this new no fixed BNR date cycle where it'll just happen suddenly, it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. If there's a quiet consensus building, people are saying, oh, it's gonna happen, but when, who knows?
It's not a quiet consensus on Twitter right now. It's a pretty loud consensus, but I figured that WotC wants to wait for GP Austin this weekend.
I mean, WotC has literally abandoned monitoring Modern the way it should be because it's not considering it to be an important format to them for whatever reason. I likened it to a dad who went out to get cigarettes and it's now been 12 years and you're still waiting for dad to come back. They do not seem to care at all.
Actually, I disagree with that in the sense that I feel like Modern has been in a pretty good spot for the last 3 or 4 months. I think that Oko was kind of in the last month or so started to become oppressive. And I think there's a general feeling that perhaps Veil of Summer and Once Upon a Time, I would not be sad to see them go in Modern either. They are just like a little bit too weirdly good of Magic cards.
Worth noting that when Sam Black brewed his Legacy deck for the NRG series, we talked about his Modern deck last week because we derive some inspiration from it. He said that he considered the key cards in Legacy to be Veil of Summer and Once Upon a Time and brewed his deck appropriately and then did not lose a match. So that tells you how powerful these cards
are. Yeah.
So a lot of changes from these standard legal expansions. The last few sets have really shaken up Eternal formats. We've got a lot of Theros previews in front of us now. How are you guys feeling about what's coming down the pipeline from Theros? Any cards in particular caught your eye?
Well, the first card I want to highlight is one that I think has caught a lot of people's eye, so I'm not breaking anyone's mind when I mention the combos associated with it, but the new Heliod, which is 2 and a white for a 5/5. Like all the monocolor gods, it needs Devotion of 5. There need to be 5 pips of specifically white in play for it to become a creature. And it has the text that whenever you gain life, you may put a +1/+1 counter on target creature. And for 1 and a white, you can target a creature and give it lifelink. So the obvious combo that I think everybody saw was that this works with Walking Ballista. We had talked at various points in the last few weeks about the 5-mana angel working with Walking Ballista. I've had some reasonable success in Pioneer already with it. And I think the expectation is that, at least in Pioneer, even bad Splinter Twin combos have been too good for the format, and that this is likely to result in a ban, which would be really sad. I love Walking Ballista. I think it's a really cool card. But I actually think this card is going to be very powerful in Modern. In addition to that combo, it immediately combos with Spike Feeder. You don't need to put any mana into it, and you can gain infinite life, which doesn't win against all decks, but it wins against a huge portion of the commonly played decks now. Collected Company, which is probably a card you want to play, finds not only Spike Feeder, it also finds a podcast favorite Ranger, Captain of Eos, which both finds Walking Ballista and can be sacrificed to protect your combo if you choose to go off that turn. So yeah, I think this is going to be a huge boon for these sort of green-white value-y decks. You're not going to have to play Knight of the Reliquary anymore, is my prediction. I can't imagine it getting banned in Modern, but I can imagine it being very powerful indeed.
Yeah, just to walk through the combo a little bit slower. So what happens is you play Heliod the Sun Crowned and a Walking Ballista with 2 counters on it. You use Heliod to give Walking Ballista lifelink for 1 and a white. Walking Ballista, you use it to hit your opponent for 1. Since it has lifelink, you gain a life. Heliod triggers to give a +1/+1 counter to Walking Ballista. Now it's back to 2 counters, and so you go back down to 1. You gain life, you go to 2, and you can just do this infinitely. Unless, of course, we have Dan's card you mentioned, Suppression Field, in play, in which case this combo gets a lot worse.
And sort of just similarly, Spike Feeder removes a +1/+1 counter for no mana to gain 2 life. In the same way that Damon's describing, you just would constantly replace the +1/+1 counter every time you do that, so you'd gain effectively infinite life. And that beats a deck like Oko as it's currently constructed. It cannot beat infinite life.
And because Heliod is an enchantment, unless Devotion is turned on, he's safe from Oko. If you want to just get Heliod in play first, he can't be elked until you're ready to do your thing.
Dave, is that true? Can the Oko decks deck you with Mystic Sanctuary Cryptic Command?
Yeah, they can. I believe they can.
Like, if they can just, like, stop everything that you do with their Okos and stuff.
We really need, like, a constantly updated list of which decks in Modern lose to Infinite Life and which decks don't. Mystic Sanctuary muddles the whole picture on that. Any deck that has Mystic Sanctuary and Cryptic Command can prevent itself from decking. Those tend to also have control elements, so it's entirely possible that you can gain Infinite Life on turn 3 or whatever and still lose, but it would just take 50 minutes. That's not a great development.
Yeah, Infinite Life is not anywhere near as good as Infinite Damage.
True. I do think that once you get to a point where you have Infinite Life, though, it gives you a... You can play the game super freely. They have to save a Cryptic Command. They have to save all their lands to come back. It's possible for them, so it's not obvious that they will lose, but it is really hard for them to win from that position.
I don't think it's actually quite that hard. It's basically they have to establish control over the game and then maintain control over the game. They don't really have to, like, keep a Cryptic Command in reserve until they're getting close to being decked, which is not hard to do because as long as you just keep a Mystic Sanctuary in the tank, they'll be fine. And so can, like, an Oko Urza deck establish a huge board advantage and card advantage and then just kind of dominate things until the opponent gives up? Like, possibly. It doesn't seem implausible.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. You get to play cards like Scavenging Ooze, for instance, to attack their graveyard.
Yeah.
What you might be leading to is lots of 50-minute game ones where you might have draws where game ones don't end. Like, Oko decks take a long time to do their thing.
Now, that's all in Modern, but in Pioneer, I think this is the format where people are wringing their hands a little more because, oh, we don't want another Saheeli Cat combo or whatever in the format. That's a little bit less clear. The reason that this combo is worth talking about, apart from just being a two-card combo, is that both Walking Ballista and Heliod are fine cards on their own. Now, Heliod on its own, if Ballista was not a card, is still a really interesting creature. It's the cheapest god at 3 mana. The 3 mana god is usually the one that you have to keep your eye on. Its triggered ability puts a +1/+1 counter on any creature or an enchantment, so we can put the counters on itself even when it's not turned on. You can even put the counters on something like Myth Realized or whatever. That's just like a useful ability. It's a mini Archangel of Thune in some kind of life gain deck. You know, I'll use the word Soul Sister to describe that, even though that's not really a Pioneer legal thing. So Heliod, I think it looks very good in some kind of white weenie strategy. If I'm playing Ballistas in there just to have the combo, I might want to look towards more +1/+1 counters. Venerated Loxodon comes to mind. So I think you just have a very good deck that happens to have this combo in Pioneer.
I actually don't like that shell for it. I like actually playing it in the Scales deck where you're just splashing white for like 2 or 3 copies of Heliod.
It sounds like we're going to have a week on this card.
Yeah. The more I think about it, actually, the more I think it's possibly more powerful in Modern just because you have more hits for it. You're already playing Walking Ballista in your infinite mana combo in your green-white Collected Company list. So maybe just another avenue of attack there. You could even play like a Collected Company list that also has just a Johnny's Pride Mate to go along with your infinite combo, along with the Soul Sisters like Dan's describing. Cards that get +1/+1 counters are actually reasonable against Oko. If you're playing a bunch of like 1 and 2 drops that get 2 +1/+1 counters, the main thing that Oko does is eliminate text, but it doesn't matter. Now you have a 5/5 or something if you make it an elf.
Yeah, so a lot of attention is going to be on this card, and we'll probably be revisiting it again soon. Let's move on, because there's a lot of other stuff to get through. There's a ton of sweet cards. What else has caught your eye?
I am super interested in Kiora Best the Sea God. I think this card is sweet. 5 blue for a saga. The first chapter is to create an 8/8 blue Kraken creature token with hexproof, which is just, whoa, that's pretty huge. Step 2 is to tap all non-land permanents your opponent controls. They don't untap during their next untap step. Step 3 is gain control of target permanent and opponent controls, untap it. This is doing 3 things that are all quite powerful. An 8/8 hexproof creature is certainly no small thing. Gaining control of a permanent is also no small thing. People play the card Agent of Treachery in Standard. 7 mana for a 2/3 creature plus a gain control effect. Of course, this comes with a delay, but still, seeing like kind of like a big game saga that you would like consider trying to like show and tell into play or whatever is interesting.
Damon, you play more Standard than the rest of us do. And I think a few different times you've mentioned Agent of Treachery as a card that, by comparison, you know, that's a playable card and so is this. I don't really believe that. I think Agent of Treachery is not relevant for Eternal formats. Both Agent of Treachery and this will give you value if you can blink it a bunch of times, but it's still 7 mana and these effects are not really coherent to me, so I don't really see it personally. Like, they don't work together in a meaningful way.
Oh, yeah. I doubt this card is going to become a Modern powerhouse. I just think it's sweet. That's all.
It is sweet, and blinking it also seems sweet. I'm a skeptic of Kiora Besting the Sea God, but a very, very sweet, very flavorful card. A card that caused a bit of discussion, some amount of debate, was Hectos the Unscarred. This is the Achilles from Theros, so it's red, white, white for a 6/1 legendary creature, attacks each combat if able, and as it enters the battlefield, you choose a number at random, either 2, 3, or 4, and then Hectos the Unscarred has protection from all converted mana costs except for the number that was chosen at random, which is his Achilles heel, I guess. Reactions to this card, some people say True Nemesis 2.0. Some people say this is the first Hearthstone card in Magic.
I've heard it called True Number Nemesis.
True Number Nemesis. Is this completely unplayable, which is something I've heard, or is this like the next Scourge?
I think the random number generator is actually important because it prevents you from being able to sort of build around it. You can't enchant it with some known enchantment card to make it, you know, unblockable or something, because it's going to be immune to that card 33% of the time.
Tree of Nemesis, you can enchant it, you can equip it because it has protection from the opponent, but this has protection from everything, including your own stuff.
Right.
So it's not hexproof. It's actually slightly, I don't know, better or worse, but you can't buff it yourself.
Well, significantly worse. Like I said, I think the random number preventing you from actually building a deck around it means that it can win games no other card can win, but you have no control over that. And that's the kind of effect that pros hate relying on. So even if it was very good, unless somebody who's not a pro actually did the work to show it, I think we'd never find out.
Yeah, it's certainly quite powerful. Red, red, white, white is quite the restrictive casting cost. And I think that's going to be this card's true downfall.
The true Achilles heel is the fact that it's a Boros card. Boros is terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, the Boros mana is okay because the enemy colors weirdly in Pioneer have better mana.
Yeah, but even still, red, red, white, white on curves is never easy for any mana base.
I don't think this card is going to be good. I think that the must attack clause is actually kind of a problem, among many other things. So I'm not expecting to see much of this, but it's an interesting design for sure. What do you guys think about these two Titan cards? Uro, Titan of Nature's Wrath, and Kroxa, Titan of Death's Hunger.
These cards seem very pushed to me. I think there was some talk about how the 6-mana Titan cycle was too good for Standard, which is hilarious. These cards seem better than those Titans by a lot, except for Primetime.
It's a bold claim.
The blue-green one especially, you're already paying a little bit more than Explorer, and you're getting something extra for it, which is 3 life, which is relevant sometimes.
You better read the text on these, because these are really interesting templating.
Yeah, so they both have a cheap initial cost. Uro is 1 blue and a green. Kroxa is a red and a black. When they come into play, if they weren't escaped, so escape is the new mechanic, if they did not escape, you must sacrifice them. And then they have a come into play ability, which for the blue-green one is you draw a card, then you may play a land from your hand, and then you gain 3 life. And the red-black one is that an opponent discards a card, and if they did not discard a non-land card, they take 3 damage.
And it's not just a common play ability, it's also an attack trigger. So enters the battlefield or attacks.
Right, just like the Titan. So they're both 6-6, and they both have a come into play and attack ability. And then they both escape for the Simic card's case, blue-blue-green-green, and in the Rakdos case, black-black-red-red. And exiling 5 cards. They will come into play as a 6-6 again and perform their action, and then on the following turns when you attack, you'll get that action again.
Yeah, so the first time you cast it, it's going to die, presumably, if you cast it from hand or something. It's kind of like you're evoking it, you're just getting the spell. Then you get the creature half when you're ready to escape it, or you can just skip the spell half, and if you can somehow get it directly in your graveyard, you can escape it. You don't have to cast it first, it can just come from the graveyard.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that all the other ways you might cheat it into play, it's going to see that it wasn't escaped and sacrifice itself immediately, so you don't get that much benefit out of bringing it back with, you know, a resurrection spell or something like that.
Right. The typical evoke tricks of blinking and stuff, they don't work in the same way. You'll get extra ETBs, but it will die.
Yeah.
They somehow don't seem that good to me. I'm surprised that you think it's really pushed, Dave. Basically, if you look at the rate of the... It's like an adventure where you cast a cheap spell to begin with, and then later on you could cast a more expensive creature. In this case, for example, you're casting this spell, like a black-red sorcery, that makes an opponent discard a card. And if they didn't discard a non-land card, they lose 3 life. And this is not the type of card that I would ever consider playing that effect on its own. Likewise, a growth spiral for 1 extra mana that gains 3 life, but as a sorcery, also seems substantially worse than just straight growth spiral. Maybe playable, but maybe not, because you already, you know, you've already played out 3 of your lands at that point. Conversely, you will get this benefit later on where you can play the escape half, but this is like a pretty restrictive casting cost with the AABB templating, along with having to escape by exiling 5 other cards. You'll get it eventually, but you have to work a lot for it.
I disagree. I think that's not a very restrictive escape cost. It's only 4 mana, first of all.
Depends on the format.
Yeah, it depends on the format. So in a fetch land format, obviously, it's quite easy, it's trivial, but the color requirements are not that hard. This total CMC is 4. That's undercosted for a 6-6, so you're getting the creature half at a great rate. Then when it escapes, you get the ETB again, and then if it lives, you get that effect over and over again every time it attacks. Maybe they'll kill it, but you just escape it again. I think these cards are extremely strong.
I definitely agree that if you have it escaped and going, they're quite strong. I just think that in the fetchland formats, is ironically the Oko format, which can disable it at least, along with having cards like Path to Exile and Rest in Peace in the sideboards, and just generally hyperpower game plans in Modern involving, you know, Tron going over the top of you, getting Lattice locked out, etc., while you're casting your derpy first half of these cards. And then the formats where you don't have fetch lands, the escape half, I think, is substantially harder because, first off, the mana bases are much worse in those formats. Second off, filling up your graveyard's harder.
Well, here's some cards just in various formats that you might think about playing. Satyr Wayfinder with the blue-green one, so it gives you an extra land in your hand, so you probably get your two land plays on turn three if you don't get to play it on turn one with your mana elf. Hushbringer and Torpor Orb let you play a 3-mana or 2-mana 6/6 on turn three. Lazav in standard lets you copy this for 2 or 3 mana and attack on turn three, if you like, so you get your attack trigger at least. Renegade Doppelganger, if you play on two and then play one of these to follow it, so you'll get the come into play trigger from your one, let it die, your Renegade Doppelganger turn into a 6/6, you get to attack and get that effect again. Citrus Supplier, another card that helps fill your graveyard and would work in a sacrifice deck if you're looking to sacrifice these guys with their initial trigger on the stack.
Pelt Collector, worst creature in Modern, but somehow a staple in Pioneer. Mythic Champion Winner in Standard.
Yeah, certainly there are cards that synergize quite well with them, Pelt Collector being the funniest of them. It sees it both entering and dying. And so, for example, Pelt Collector into Uro immediately gets you a 3-3. The Lozov stuff is interesting, but you have to have a way to get these in the graveyard to begin with. The Hushbringer thing, it's a very clever idea. It requires you to build this weird Hushbringer deck, and you kind of go down a card casting Hushbringer as a 1-2 lifelink. But we'll see.
Hushbringer does have text against cards like the actual Titan Cycle. It also has text against Urza.
Yeah, if your opponent is playing, like, humans, you know, it's actually a great card.
That's still a thing, humans, but...
Worth noting that when we ran our You Pick the Card poll, Torpor Orb was one of the top finishers in the poll. Between Torpor Orb and Hushbringer, you have a lot of copies of the same effect, the Rule of Eight. So if you want to build a deck like that, Sundial of the Infinite is in a similar space. There are enough effects now. We're getting more and more creatures that can pay you off on that. But anyway, we're getting deep into the weeds on those corner cases. I think the base rate on these, to me, is already enticing. And then once you start to think about just the weird templating, the weird stats and mana costs, I think you're going to find that these creatures are like the most exciting thing for all these sort of weird decks you might try to build. And for that reason, they are definitely worth tracking closely and exploring further, I think.
Sundial of the Infinite also has the weird corner case where you get to keep the positive effect and not the negative effect if you stack them correctly. Torpor Orb stops the die effect, sure, but then you don't get the come into play effect. Sundial, you let the come into play effect resolve, and then you stop the sacrifice effect. Worth noting.
There you go. Talk to me about Dryad of the Elysian Grove.
This card seems absolutely insane to me. People should be considering rebuilding Valakut decks with this as your like targeted 3-drop. It is built in the mold of Courser, so it's an enchantment creature that's 2/4 for 3 mana. Unlike Courser, you don't gain a life when a land comes into play and you can't play off the top of your deck. However, you have the ability to play an extra land per turn, and it has a text which makes all of your lands in play all basic land types. This interaction with Valakut is very important. It means that Valakut, when it comes into play, is now an actual good land to draw in your Valakut deck because it starts to trigger on your 6th land because Valakut sees itself as a mountain. And just your standard opening of Grazer on 1, play your 2nd land, play this on 2, play a 4th land. On your next turn, you can play a 5th land in Hour of Promise for 2 lands, which can both be Valakuts. They see themselves as mountains, so that's 18 damage right there. And then you can play another land that turn because of this thing's ability. It also means that you can scapeshift with 1 less land in play. So just playing this on 3 with no accelerator, play a 4th land that turn, and then your next turn play 2 lands scapeshift as an auto kill because you can fetch all 4 Valakuts and you do, you know, way more than 20. So sometimes you can gain life so the 18 damage doesn't kill you, blah, blah, blah. This solves all of that. So this card just seems insane to me. It seems super powerful.
It has the text of the Enchantment Prismatic Omen, which only has that line of text. Let lands have all basic land types. And sometimes Valakut decks used to play that just for that effect.
Yeah, maybe like as a 1 or 2 of. Yeah, just because that effect is so powerful with Valakut. But to tie it to a land accelerator, it also survives Anger of the Gods, which is a defensive card that they wanted to play oftentimes anyway.
Mm.
It functionally has a come into play ability because that turn you play it, you likely have an extra land drop, which is already something that Valakut wants to play. Now, this card just seems very powerful to me.
Valakut decks typically play at most 0 to 1 Prismatic Omens, and they typically do not play cards like Azusa. So I'm not completely sure sure it's going to slot in there. I think it is more powerful than either of those cards in that deck. So I think definitely as like a one of in Titan Shift. I'm not convinced it's going to become a clean four of or anything like that.
Probably not a four of, but keep in mind that Valakut is in that space where that deck is evolving pretty rapidly in the past 3 weeks or so. When you hear the word Valakut, it used to be that you could just imagine the exact 60, but now it's like, it's not really clear. Are they playing Grazer? Are they playing Castle Gearenbriggs? Are they, how many Field of the Deads are they playing? Like, the demands on the mana base when you're trying to incorporate these other angles can sometimes get in the way. This Dryad seems to smooth all that over while allowing you to also accelerate. Interesting card.
This card is also going to be worth a zillion dollars because of EDH. If you get a chance, like if you open this or whatever on opening night, you should always, always take this. Even if it's not that good and limited. This card is literally going to be worth like $30.
Well, it's not a mythic. It's a basic rare.
Yeah, but this is a staple. This is going to go in every green deck and every five-color deck especially. Like, imagine casting this and then Last Stand.
Last Stand? Was that from Apocalypse?
Apocalypse.
Okay, all right. We are neither a finance podcast nor an EGH podcast, but this card does not provide card advantage, which a card like Oracle of Moldiah does. You know, for EDH, it's not the slam dunk hit that card like Oracle is. It's more in the Wayward Swordtooth category.
Well, Oracle of Moldiah, you get to play, I think, one of those. So you got 99 slots left. This card is going to see play in every green deck and every five-color deck in EDH.
All right. Back to Modern and Pioneer. How about Whirlwind Denial?
This card is a mystery. So this is 2 and a blue for an instant. Counter all spells and activated abilities that your opponents control unless they pay 4 for each one that they want to resolve. It seems like this is kind of geared up against, first off, if somebody has like Ad Nauseam Tendrils and they have Tendrils and Storm is 10, they get the 10 copies and you can counter all of them with this card. Or in Modern, if somebody plays Ulamog and has a cast trigger, you can then stop both the Ulamog and the exile effect.
So there's a similar effect that had been printed earlier, which is Summary Dismissal. It's 2 colorless and 2 blue, and it exiles all spells on the stack and all abilities on the stack. This just targets your opponents and it's one less. Summary Dismissal was always already seeing play as like a 1-2-3 of in like blue white sideboard in Pioneer to beat the green ramp deck because they can go over the top of you with Ulamog or Emrakul. This card is just better than that. So just as a straight up sideboard card in Pioneer, this is for sure a 2 of. Whether it will see play in Modern, that is a little harder to believe.
There's one tricky thing about that. So siding in cards like, as I've learned, Mystical Dispute against like a Simic Flash deck, if you can play it to stop their Nissa, it's great. If they ever resolve the Nissa, they can just pay the 3, no problem. I do wonder if the fail case where your wrap opponent just has 4 extra mana lying around will be sufficiently dangerous that this card is not actually as good as it looks.
There's an interesting corner case interaction in Modern that's kind of interesting, which also applies to Summary Dismissal. I mentioned that there was a Titan Shift deck that had 4 main deck Veil of Summers. This card can, weirdly enough, get around a lethal Scape Shift because Veil of Summer does not protect their triggered abilities. So if they cast Escape Shift on you and you suspect they have Veil of Summer, you're actually not dead. You let it resolve. Valakut triggers go on the stack. Play this, counters all the Valakut triggers, and the Veil does not protect those. So you will survive the Escape Shift. But that's about it for Modern.
I mean, if you're an Amulet Titan player, cast Summoner's Pact to get Prime Time, and they play it off of Cavern of Souls for their second green mana, and they're going to get their extra green off of the trigger, all of a sudden you can completely blow them out and make them lose a Summoner's Pact, which is at least seems like it'd be fun to do at least once in your life. And here's the thing with this card is that you say sideboard only, but suppose it just read 2 and a blue counter target spell with this potential like kind of extreme case benefit. That's like maybe in the ballpark of good. I mean, I've gone as far as playing cards like Didn't Say Please in Modern, and while they weren't great, they weren't that bad.
I mean, 3 mana counter spells are as good as it gets in Pioneer. If it reads 2 and a blue counter spell, it's the best counter spell in Pioneer.
Yeah, paying 4 is, that's actually a fair amount. It actually probably will just be a live counter spell a lot of the time.
I'm not advising that anyone do that, unless these Ulamog decks suddenly rise up to the very tippy top of the metagame.
I mean, people play Supreme Will, Dan.
Supreme Will is a much different card.
Sure.
Much better. So a card that intrigues me, Phoenix of Ash, 1 red-red, 2/2 flying haste, escape for 2 red-red, and exile 3 other cards from your graveyard. When it escapes, it comes in with an extra counter, so it comes in at a 3/3 out of the graveyard. It has an activated ability, 2 and a red, Phoenix of Ash gets +2/+0 until end of turn. Phoenixes have a weird history of Magic where for a long time the joke was there's a terrible Phoenix in every set. Suddenly every Kindling Phoenix was like, oh, maybe this one's kind of good. And then Arclight Phoenix, as we know, actually turned out to be really, really good. And then we discovered uses for cards like Flame Wake Phoenix. This Phoenix, I don't hear a lot of chatter about it because all these things involve mana. Like you have to actually cast cast it. You have to escape it for 4 mana. But the stats here look good to me. The escape cost is only 3 cards, and it has haste, which I've often said haste is a very underrated ability. So I actually like this card quite a lot as just a creature to play on your 3 slot.
Yeah, I actually think the activated ability to give it +2/+0 is hugely important. Because this Phoenix does not have to attack, unlike all these other Phoenixes, it can actually trade for all these 4 toughness beaters that like Mono Green is playing. So late in the game, if you're playing Flamewake Phoenix, you're just sort of stuck, right? You can bring it back, but you're forced to attack. And if you're losing the race, which a lot of times you are against like Mana Dork into 3 drop that has 4 or 5 power, you end up losing that race. Red does not have the tools to race green, especially I'm talking specifically in Pioneer. This card's ability to chump block on the front end or trade if you have the mana up, and then to just keep coming back and doing that over and over again is really powerful. And the fact that it can buff itself to 4 power means it can get back Flamewake Phoenix if you like, which is a very important cycle in some of these decks where you're trying to either get Rekindling Phoenix or whatever. It allows you to just stick one threat and all of a sudden you've got a bunch of flying creatures back in play. You negated multiple turns of removal from them.
Yeah, what seems strongest about the card to me is that it helps in the mono red fail case, which is almost always when you flood out. And this card just gives you a lot of different things to do with your mana, whether it be reviving it or just pumping it. If you have 6 mountains in play, normally that's like a death sentence to some sort of mono red burn deck to draw that many. But with this card, you can probably just keep the pressure going.
For the same reason, it seems like a great card for a Fires of Invention deck, where, again, a fail case would be not having anything to do with your mana or not having cards to play. This gives you both. Next card.
Well, in the mono red camp, there's a Tectonic Giant. This one is 2 red for a 3/4 elemental giant. When it attacks or becomes the target of a spell an opponent controls, choose one. Either it deals 3 damage to each opponent, or you exile the top 2 cards and do this kind of impulsive draw where you choose one of them and until the end of your next turn you can play that card.
We had a bit of an argument about this card in our little G-chat. I think this card is a trap. This is not a card that I want to play. It has this new line of text: whenever it becomes the target of a spell an opponent controls, you get to do its effect. So it kind of looks like it has protection, but that's the trap. You'll still run in headfirst into cards like Teferi, Oko, Reflector Mage, and you won't get anything out of this. You'll just get, you spent your 4 mana and did nothing.
Yeah, I don't think I would play it in a format where Oko was legal. This card is not modern level. But I think in Standard or in perhaps Pioneer, it attacks for 6, right?
If you wanted to.
It just kind of puts on the pressure.
Yeah, and White-Blue's 1-for-1 interaction is Azorius Charm. So if you catch them where that's the way that they're having to interact with it, that is a really bad exchange for them, where you get to attack, trigger it once, and then they Azorius Charm it, you get to trigger it again.
I disagree, because what about Blessed Alliance? What about Supreme Verdict? What about Teferi? Like, those are also cards you'll find in the main deck. If any of those happen, it's a disaster for you. Like, you spent your entire 4th turn doing this thing and got almost nothing out of it.
Well, Blessed Alliance is a real corner case. Most blue-white decks are not playing any.
Also, Blessed Alliance only works when it's attacking. At the point it's attacking, you've already got a trigger off of it. Same with Seal Away.
You got 3 damage in, but it's still not very good.
Well, if it's early game against blue-white, you probably took the draw card version.
Time will tell. I mean, it's not even a real draw.
Yeah, but you get one of the top 2. Teferi does kind of mess with it, though. Teferi Time Rifle is just such a card.
Going down the list, the first Eroan Games.
Yeah, I think this card is a very cool card in Pioneer. I mean, right now Pioneer's gameplay is dictated a lot by Mana Guy into 3-drop. This is an interesting variant on that. It gives you a 1-1, which is relevant to Lovestruck Beast, which is maybe the best of the green 3-drops. It also then adds 3 additional power the next turn. If you need to break a board self, you need to make your Lovestruck Beast better than their Lovestruck Beast, for instance. That's very important. Or if you just want, if you don't have another beater to play, you can just buff up the 1-1 that you created. And then on your next turn, you get to draw 2 cards. It's delayed, but you're basically getting a divination out of this thing that added 4 power. And then at the end, you get a gold token, which is just great flavor. You've won the gold medal after all of your hard training. I don't know that that gold at the end is really worth anything, but I mean, it's not nothing, but it's close to nothing. But I think the first 3 abilities, especially in like post-board games with green, which turn a little grindy, really are going to help you break the mirror.
Do we know what the gold does?
Yeah, a gold is a treasure that doesn't have to tap to sacrifice itself.
First seen on the card Guild from the original Theros, and then on King Makar the Gold Cursed from Born of the Gods.
Yep. So it's a strictly better treasure.
If you can do all the chapters in this without being disrupted, you'll get great value. You'll end up with 4 power and 4 toughness worth of stuff. You'll get 2 cards, and then you'll have this nice little, you won the prize, you get a gold token. If they prevent you from doing either chapter 2 or chapter 3, if they prevent you from putting 3+1+1 counters on something or from drawing 2 cards, it's not so exciting. However, most likely they had to spend some resources to stop you from doing that. So I think cumulatively, I like the package here. When you're imagining the fail cases, when you look at it, you still only spent one card on this, and they had to respond to it to stop you from getting these big advantages. So I like this card quite a lot.
Well, let's imagine your interaction here, Dan. I play this on 2, you play Teferi on 3 and bounce it to take me off my thing. I just kill your Teferi and replay it. That's a great exchange against blue-white control.
Ooh, say that again?
What are you bouncing with Teferi?
You're playing Teferi to take me off my second and third counter, so you're blinking my enchantment.
No, I'm blinking your 1-1.
Yeah, we blink the creature.
Okay, then I'm killing your Teferi with my mana guy after I buff it up.
Right, I'm okay with that exchange too. I think you come out ahead on the green side in that exchange.
Yeah, which is kind of scary. That's a strong card. Like, the fail case here is that you have nothing else going on. You play 2 and a green and you went up with a 4-4 on the turn you would first attack with it. So it's kind of like just a 4-4 for 3.
I guess the fail case is that you're behind on board and you need a blocker, and this does not give you that.
Right. It does take a turn to kind of charge up the creature.
I also like that it's like a hidden source of 1-1s for Lovestruck Beast. It is the case where I've been able to like kill the 1-1 creature so that you're stranding these Lovestruck Beasts in play. The fact that it gives you a 1-1 that turn immediately is not trivial.
It's also a source of +1/+1 counters if you're interested in hardened scales, ballista, or anything like that. So a lot you can do with this. This is a nice option to have at 3 mana, even without synergies, but with synergies, there could be something there for sure.
One card that actually looks pretty interesting to me for Modern and Pioneer is the card Soul Guide Lantern, which is a 1-mana artifact that on ETB lets you exile a card from a graveyard and then tap, sacrifice itself, exile each opponent's graveyard, 1-tap, sack, draw a card. And so it's kind of like, compares to Relic of Progenitus. You can immediately exile a card and then sack it to exile their whole graveyard. And it's kind of like not quite Relic in the sense that if you exile their graveyard, you don't draw a card. Whereas with Relic, if you sack it, you do draw the card. On the other hand, this one has one huge advantage. It doesn't require mana to activate, which I've lost many, many games to Dredge or whatever with Relic, where I just didn't have the mana up to play it and use it in the same turn. Whereas this card, the exiling of their whole graveyard, is just for free. And also, I think that exiling a single card of your choice on ETB is probably better than Relics, where they choose on tap that's reusable, but still the first activation is not as good.
This card looks great to me. I'm really surprised that they printed this, and I'm pleased that they did. So many of the cards we've been talking about have the escape ability. Escape gives you card advantage out of the graveyard, but it also demands that you have stuff to fuel the escape. Here's a ready-made answer that you can just put in your main deck because it has the ability to cycle. When you compare it to other anti-graveyard cards, this is actually a unique set of effects, and it doesn't exile itself. It doesn't exile your own graveyard like Relic does. Doesn't exile itself. So it kind of is screaming, play me with Emry. Yeah, if you need a Mistress Bauble type effect that you can start cycling for extra cards while also incidentally hating out some of the more powerful graveyard strategies, if those are important, here's a Soul Guide Lantern ready-made for the job.
I mean, I'm not surprised they printed this card. This is the kind of thing they should always be doing, is if you're going to introduce a constructed mechanic, which Escape is, I think we can all agree on that now, you have to have the emergency button in case of emergency break glass, and you can play some amount of these, you know, when they haven't had cards that interact with energy or other things like that. If they miss on that mechanic and it becomes too powerful and there's no way to interact with it, then you have a standard format where there's a series of bannings again. So I take this as a very good sign that they actually did learn some lessons from specifically the Kaladesh days, and it's encouraging that they understand how powerful Escape is.
Yeah, well, the scary thing is this might let them print more pushed graveyard cards. There's a better hoser around.
Well, they're already printing crazy pushed graveyard cards, so I mean...
Okay, what about the Birth of Meletus? Saga 1 and a white. Chapter 1, search your library for a basic planes, reveal it, put it in your hand. Chapter 2, create a 0/4 wall token. Chapter 3, gain 2 life.
This card seems pretty medium to me. The only thing that is really worth a card here is Chapter 1, where you get a basic planes. Getting a 0/4 and 2 life. I guess these are good effects against like a burn deck, but that's really about it.
I think this card compares pretty favorably to Wall of Omens. You get your land right away, so it functions as for sure a land. You know, sometimes you look at your mana count with Wall of Omens, we've all done this, and all right, how many cards is this draw worth? How many lands do I want to play? This always gets you a land. In the original translation, it said any basic land. That was very interesting, but basic planes, okay, we can live with that. The 0/4 is an artifact creature, if that becomes relevant. In formats with Flicker Wisp, you kind of curve naturally into getting a bunch of extra value off this. Modern is not about that at all right now, but if a similar card gets printed in Pioneer, that's about where you'd want to be in terms of power level.
The part that interests me is that this, if you squint, this is an enchantment that sacrifices for value. If you're playing a card like Starfield of Nyx as your top end or something, this is a card that will get you some value and then put itself conveniently in the graveyard so you can do it all again. Or blink it, like Dave was saying. Or just have a free permanent lying around for something like Doom Foretold or your Vraska Golgari Queen. I mean, we talked about Treacherous Blessing last week as another enchantment that gives you something and then sticks around for you to get rid of it for more value. It's not an exciting fighting card, but it's a glue piece to have in the arsenal.
You could play it with Riptide Chimera, which is a card which requires you to bounce an enchantment every turn.
Oh, yeah.
If you stack your triggers correctly, every turn for 2 mana, you get a Plains to your hand and an 0/4 wall.
Wait, isn't that during your upkeep that you bounce a card?
Oh, yeah, because the Sagas, when they were considering eliminating upkeep. Well, fair enough.
Right, Sagas trigger
at the beginning of your first main.
Yeah, a card that I wasn't sure about, but the more I think about it, I want to take a chance on it, is Nadir Kraken. 1 blue for a 2/3. Whenever you draw a card, you may pay 1. If you do, put a +1/+1 counter on Nadir Kraken and create a 1/1 creature.
This card is so hard to say. It's one of those cards where if you play it and it just dies, you are sad.
Right, the fail case looks really sad. However, here's what I like about it. It's kind of like a young Pyromancer that you don't have to fuel. You don't have to play anything to trigger the draw card. You just naturally draw a card in your turn. So if it just sits there, you can play Protect the Queen with this. Not only will it give you 1/1s, but it also grows itself to actually end the game. I'm willing to take a chance on this, but maybe I'm crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly much easier to trigger than a card like the draw two effects, like Ironcrag Pyromancer or Improbable Alliance. This just lets you draw 1, which is just a billion times easier and happens naturally. And so in that sense, this might be pretty good in Pioneer. I'm skeptical in Modern. Legacy has Brainstorm, which lets you use it 3 times, which is just insane.
Well, it is gated by mana. You have to pay 1 every time you draw. So in that sense, it's not that exciting.
We've had similar cards that get +1/+1 from draw, right? There's a snake that's blue, green, and colorless. And then there was the mono blue card that's 2 and a blue. It starts as a 1/1. And when it dies, all of the +1/+1 counters become 1/1 island walk cards.
So that's Chasm Skulker and Lower Scale Coital.
Yeah. Both of those saw some amount of play in certain formats. This requiring mana to use all those extra draws is a huge downside, but like you say, Dan, each draw actually adds 2 power to play instead of 1. So it's better in the less explosive draws than those other cards, and it's worse in the actual like explosive draws. So I guess it depends on how sort of tempo-based Standard or Pioneer is. Right now, Pioneer is very tempo-based, so I don't think you're going to have time to get the value you want out of it.
Yeah, I forgot about Chasm Skulker. Maybe that's just a better version. And I could be wrong about this, so I don't want to die on this particular hill, but it's one I got my eye on, back pocket. Any other cards have your attention, Dave?
I really like the new Thassa Deep Dweller. So it's 3 and a blue, has the God tech, so it requires 5 blue pips. At the end of your turn, it blinks a creature you control and returns it under your control. And it has 2 kind of interesting things about it. 1, it does it all at once, so you can blink Master Waves and your elementals won't die. So those are both cards that are interested in having blue pips. 2, it has that sort of permanent steel text, like Restoration Angel. So if you temporarily take control of something and you blink it at end of turn, it's yours forever. Both of those are interesting effects to consider. So just playing like Risen Reef, Master of Waves, and this Thassa, that's already something I'm kind of interested in. I don't know what the like cheap ways to take other people's creatures are. You know, there's the Eldrazi Obligator you could play on 5 very naturally. You'd get that creature permanently. That's very interesting to me.
Claim the Firstborn, maybe.
Playing the Firstborn.
There's that new Saga.
The red one, yeah.
Yeah, and unlike Soul Herder, this card is an indestructible creature, and so it's very likely to stick around, and so they can't just attack on this axis very easily. If you're building your deck around it, you can expect it to be there more reliably.
Right, the rest of the stats on this do not impress. It's 4 mana, it's 6/5 without evasion, and the activated ability is 4 mana to tap a creature. I don't really want to do that. But all that together suggests that this end step trigger is actually quite strong. That's the main selling point of the card. And yeah, the Soul Herder comparison, I think, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so it's 1 extra mana, but Pioneer is a turn or 2 slower than Modern, and additionally, as Damon says, it's uninteractable along most typical interaction lines that decks possess. You could never play enough blue cards, for instance, to make it a creature, and it would just be a constant source of blinking whatever you want to put in play.
Okay, so that is some of the exciting new previews from Theros. We are going to be revisiting a lot of these, I'm sure, in the future weeks, but we'll leave it at that for now. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more. Welcome back. Normally, we next go to a flashback to our car from last week, which was Gear for Orrery. We are actually going to postpone that segment until our next show because we want to leave more time for a brand new segment. debuting in this episode that we are calling the Brew Review. The Brew Review is where we have solicited our fine listeners to send us some of your sweetest brews, some of your most interesting ideas. Of course, we are always interested in hearing cool ideas from listeners. You can get in touch with us by Twitter. We're at FaithlessMTG. You can email us. But if you join our Patreon, if you want to throw some Patreon support, one of the several benefits that you'll receive is you have the option to send in your lists and have us review them on air in this new segment. So we put out the call to our patrons to see what they've been brewing, and we got quite a number of really interesting decks, and we're going to just run through them quick, try to capture the essence of what is the creative spark behind this deck, what are the promising ideas, what are the sort of theses or questions that it's trying to test out, or what are the promising cards that it's trying to take advantage of. That being said, let's dive right in. Damon, you want to start us off?
Yeah, so the first list I have is titled Mono Red Blitz by Jiggy Wiggy, who I had the pleasure of meeting at Magic Fest Portland. The way I would describe the list is as a combination of affinity and kind of like a Bushwhacker build. To be clear, this is a modern deck. And so you have 4 Memnite, 4 Ornithopter, 4 Bomek Courier, 4 Signal Pest. I guess Bomek Courier isn't a traditional affinity card, but the other ones are. And then it has 4 Mox Opal, 4 Springleaf Drum, which are definitely affinity cards. And it couples that with 4 Robber of the Rich, 4 Seasoned Pyromancer, 3 Reckless Bushwhacker, 4 Galvanic Blast, 4 Light of the Stage, and Experimental Frenzy. Very aggressively slanted deck. What do you think?
Yeah, I like a lot of what this deck is doing. I think the land count is exactly right. I think with 4 Mox Opal, 4 Springleaf Drum, you only really need 16 lands in the deck. The one thing I'm a little curious about is the card advantage package. We've talked about Experimental Frenzy before, and I think that card is great. But the Robber of the Rich is a card I find to be very interesting. So I think the theory is you play out your whole hand, and then you get to play this Robber of the Rich, and hopefully you'll flip cards from your opponent that you get to play. I'm not sure that you need that kind of effect. I think that Seasoned Pyromancer and Light Up the Stage are plenty of card advantage. And I think I'd want the full set of Reckless Bushwhacker because I think that card just works so well with the rest of the deck in terms of getting the opponent dead in a hurry. If I was going to sort of iterate on this deck, I think at this point in Modern, a white splash is kind of free. You can turn the mountains into the red-white fast lands. You can turn some of the mountains into the red-white horizon lands. And you can just play the red-white dual lands. One reason I'd consider doing that is because I'd maybe want to play Toolcraft Exemplar to kind of have another one drop that has a lot of power. It would basically function as a Wild Mikado in this list. And I would consider playing maybe one or two Legion's Landing, which is a card that you could expect to flip with some frequency. But yeah, I think this deck looks really powerful. It looks really fun to play because your opponent is going to complain when you Galvanic Blast them for the last 4 points, and they're going to show you their hand that they had all these. But the best form of card advantage sometimes is just killing your opponent when they're looking at a grip of cards.
Yeah, to me, this list strikes me as like mono red card draw, and I think that's like maybe how Jiggy would describe it. I think it actually starts from card draw as the place where that's the thing you're trying to explore. You have a critical mass of cards like Bomek Courier, Seasoned Pyromancer, Robber of the Rich, and Experimental Frenzy and Light Up the Stage that all are like red card draw. And I think the concept here is what do you do to take advantage of all those? Play as many cheap spells, free spells as you possibly can, which is why you have the affinity component of 0 mana cards. That being said, the Robber of the Rich is the one that I just don't believe in. I haven't tried it, so maybe that's I'll be impressed, but if I were going to build this, I would probably lean into the fact that Seasoned Pyromancer and Experimental Frenzy and Light Up the Stage, those are proven cards, and they're actually slightly mana hungry. I might want to put even something like a Talisman or something, or get that bridge, make sure I'm hitting my Pyromancer and my Frenzy empty-handed on the appropriate turn of the game. But apart from that, I love what this list is doing.
I think the one card I'd like to see maybe added is Cranial Plating plus Ornithopter is just one of the most powerful lines Affinity has early. I kind of see why this deck doesn't go for that, but still, Cranial Plating, what a card.
It is mana hungry, but it's a great card.
What if you had Cranial Plating plus Embercleave in this deck? Oh my gosh.
Another card you could play if you really wanted to lean into sort of the like Bushwhacker appeal is Kadoltha Rebirth. You've got a lot of artifacts just kind of lying around, especially in the late game. Sacrificing a Mox Opal or something is sort of trivial. Getting to Kadoltha Rebirth into Whacker, that's a lot of damage out of nowhere.
I love the sound of that.
Well, that's that on that list. Shall we move to the next one?
Yeah, so we got a very interesting Pioneer list from Matt Baker, he named it Cryptolith Pod. Unfortunately, or fortunately maybe, we're not allowed to play Birthing Pod in Modern or Pioneer, but when people use Pod, what they mean is they've got a bunch of interesting cards at various spots on the curve that they have various tutor effects for. So I'm not going to go through all the hits because there's a ton of them, but he is using Cryptolith Rite. So Cryptolith Rite, for people who don't know, is a 1 green enchantment, and it gives all your creatures the text, tap, add 1 mana of any color to your mana pool. So sort of unlike Urza, the creature has to not be sick. So the creature actually has this ability, but it turns them all into Birds of Paradise in addition to all their other text. The tutoring effects that he's playing are 3 Prime Speaker Vanifar. She saw a lot of play in the early days of Pioneer when she could fetch up the cat combo. Here she has got a plethora of targets, and then to sort of supplement that tutor package, he has 2 Court of Callings. So we'll just go quickly over some of the cards he has in play. One, I love Gilded Goose with Cryptolith Rite. So Gilded Goose, again, like we talked about when Eldraine was first previewed, it gives you something, and then once Cryptolith Rite is in play, the goose is just a Bird of Paradise anyway. So you're just left with this free food, and you have all this mana lying around because of Cryptolith Rite. He's playing a Biomancer's Familiar, a Corridor Monitor, Catacomb Sifter, Reflector Mage. The big combo seems to be Eldrazi Displacer. Eldrazi Displacer can bounce Brood Monitor infinitely, and if you have anything that triggers off of cards dying, he has 2 Zulaport Cutthroats. You can gain infinite life and kill and do infinite damage to your opponent. I tend to love lists like these. There's a lot of cool little interactions you can find. And the question sometimes you need to ask yourself is sort of one of these interactions enough better than the others that I'd rather just reduce my number of options to maybe get the more powerful 2 or 3 interactions more frequently? What do you guys think?
Yeah, just to review one of these combos, because I had to kind of think about it for a couple seconds. Eldrazi Displacer lets you flicker a Brood Monitor for 2 and a colorless, 3 total. Brood Monitor is a 6-mana 3/3 Eldrazi drone that ETBs, gives you 3/1/1 Eldrazi Scions that sack for 1 mana each. And so you can flicker the Brood Monitor, you get 3 1/1s, those sack in turn for 3 mana. To flicker the Brood Monitor again, you have a loop to get infinite Brood Monitor ETBs and infinite token sacks, which combined with a card like Zulaport Cutthroat, which drains for 1 on each creature dying, will drain them for infinite life.
So all the combos in this build do involve the card Eldrazi Displacer, if I'm understanding this correctly.
Yeah, there's really only a couple of them. Eldrazi Displacer plus Biomancer's Familiar and Eyeless Watcher infinitely combos with Zulaport Cutthroat, or just Eldrazi Displacer and Brood Monitor in play with Zulaport Cutthroat.
And will an active Vanifar be able to get you this combo in one go using cards like a Corridor Monitor and Renegade Rallier?
No.
Yeah, it's an interesting use of Vanifar in the sense that it doesn't have a deterministic chain that goes all the way up.
No.
You can use Vanifar to find the Biomancer Familiar, the Displacer, and the Eyeless Watcher. You don't have to go as high as Brood Monitor. That is not a kill yet, but that is infinite Scions. You can't start from just a Vanifar. If you have a couple mismatched peaches just on the battlefield, Vanifar will sort of smooth them out and create them into something a little more pleasing.
Yeah, I mean, Vanifar here is basically just a value Vanifar, like we'd say. She's going to find what you need in a given situation. I really love this card, and I think using it in this way is a very legitimate way to attack the Pioneer format.
I love a lot of the things going on this list, too many of them, in fact, and I think for that reason I agree with Dave's overall assessment that maybe there's just a few too many things happening here, and I think Matt admitted as much when he sent this in. These are some of his favorite combinations of things, but there's a lot going on here. Cards that stand out to me as the best ones, Duskwatch Recruiter, of course the Displacer combo, and I think Biomancer's Familiar has been an underexplored card, personally.
Yeah, I actually think I would really increase my Biomancer Familiar count, my Duskwatcher Recruiter count, and I wouldn't worry that much about Servant of the Conduit or Amara, Soul of the Accord. Those are the types of games you don't want to play. Just Biomancer's Familiar plus Duskwatcher Recruiter the next turn, activate it. That's already great. That's getting you on your way to the point where they need to start killing your Duskwatch Recruiter, but it's not actually part of your infinite combo. It's finding other pieces already. So you're just getting ahead of the removal that they're trying to play.
There's a second angle to this deck. If you look really closely, there's a card Catacomb Sifter is a 3 of, which also makes an Eldrazi Scion. That leans more towards the standard Cryptolith Rite Catacomb Sifter Westvale Abbey deck, standard Days of Yore, which is also very good, and there's Westvale Abbeys here as well. So that's almost like another direction. I almost just want to separate these out and make 2 different decks, because I think that the Scion angle is quite interesting as well. you know, there's Servant of the Conduits here. With Scions, you could maybe even play Aetherworks Marvel to trigger that a bunch of times by sacking Scions or something like that. There's a lot of ways to combine these jigsaw puzzle pieces. I love the ideas going on here, and I might just want to like play around with them some more and see what else we can come up with.
And just one other avenue to consider is you could abandon your Thought-Not Seer, Voldaren, Pariah, Brood Monitor, and make those collected companies, and just really focus on using your Prime Speaker Zagana just to kind of find the missing pieces. And you only really need to get up to Eyeless Watcher with Biomancer's Familiar and an Eldrazi Displacer.
True. We're going to post all these lists. We post all the lists that we discuss in the show notes every week. For these lists especially, check the show notes and we'll have links to all these decks as well. Some of them with nice descriptions from the authors about sort of what they're trying to achieve conceptually. That being said, the next list up comes from Shane B. That is Shane Beeps, one of the co-hosts of The Dive Down, our friends of The Dive Down. This was not submitted specifically for this segment, but The Dive Down had an episode a couple weeks ago where they decided to put their brewing caps on and focus on the card Monastery Mentor in Pioneer specifically. They each tried their hand at brewing a Monastery Mentor deck. One was a green-white tokens deck, one was more of a Mardu Pyromancer style, and one was, I think, a Esper Mentor. It was a great episode. You should definitely go give that one a listen. They had interesting mixed results. Overall, the impression, I think, was that this is just a really difficult card to make work, the Monastery Mentor. I want to focus on the green-white build that Shane played. This is one where I feel like there were just little things. When I was listening to Shane describe it, I felt like it feels like it's right there, but I just want to tweak a couple things. The concept behind this, it is a green-white deck starting with your eight elves. Most of your advantage is going to come from cards like Nissa, Voice of Zendikar, Gideon, Ally of Zendikar, and Monastery Mentor, producing a lot of tokens. And then to sort of fill it all out, you have two mana cards that can produce two tokens, like Raise the Alarm, Saprolene Migration, or bigger versions of that effect, like Secure the Wastes, March of the Multitude, and then some little role players like Legion's Landing, Oath of Ajani, Venerated Loxodon to add a lot of power to the board. Problems that Shane identified talking about his own testing results was that the mana base was just a little bit off. This is an ally-colored deck, and in Pioneer, the ally mana base is just painfully awkward. The only really strong ally-color pair aggro deck is Gruul, and as we talked about before, that deck ends up playing Game Trail, the reveal land from Shadows Over Innistrad, instead of the check land. So I think that's the most important change, is that you have to accept that as a deck that is trying to play these mana elves, you really need to have as many untapped green sources on turn one as you can. So the card Fortified Village from Shadows Over Innistrad is, I think, the land that you need to achieve that, as opposed to something like Sun Petal Grove. Secondly, the card that I think I would want to try is Flower Flourish. Monastery Mentor, like a Young Pyromancer, is going to trigger and make a monk for you every time you cast a non-creature spell. In a color combination like green-white that is famously low on card draw, it's hard to sort of repeatedly trigger that, but Flower Flourish, it takes one of your land slots, because the flower half can just replace a land, basically. And then the Flourish half, which is 6 mana for a sad overrun effect, is almost free in that sense. In theory, if you're executing your plan, build up a board with a lot of tokens, eventually you'll just draw a Flourish and hopefully win that way. What do you guys think of this green-white mentor style?
You know, it's interesting. The green-white tokens list that have had some success in Pioneer, they don't play mana elves, but I think we're forced to because we need to get Monastery Mentor online quite early. You know, it's actually quite a bit weaker than most of the three drops that people are playing with mana elves. I think you need to play a lot more lands, period. Only 21 is not enough. And I really have found that Secure the Wastes and March of the Multitudes are cards you only want very few of. The key with Monastery Mentor is to get free activations the turn you play it. And so I would want to play some amount of Conclave Tribunal's main, maybe two. I would not play any Secure the Wastes at all, and March of the Multitudes at least could be played for free with our mentor. Another card I think looks good, but is actually a trap, is Oath of Ajani. These cards are only good if you already have a large board. If you already have a large board, you don't need another card to win. You already have Nissa, Gideon, Venerated Loxodon, etc. So, yeah, I'd play some amount of Flower Flourish, maybe a couple of those, and I'd trim away some of these cards that look good, but once you start playing with them, you realize, like, Secure the Wastes is just not where you want
to
be.
Do you think there's any merit to trying to protect your mentor with cards like God's Willing, or even there's a Convoke card that gives the creature indestructible?
You know, I think in Modern there's more something to that, because often the board is a little less crowded, and if you can get a couple turns because of how cheap cantrips are, you can kind of go off and get 4 or 5 tokens, or make your mentor plus 1 or 2 tokens so big that the game ends. Pioneer is so tempo focused that I think a lot of times you're actually going to be behind the eight ball. Green deck might not even bother targeting your mentor. They might just be attacking with a 5/5. You just don't have the kind of spells that cascade into more spells. So this type of build is going to have a hard time catching up. You're going to need to be blocking already. And if you have spells that are just rotting in your hand, hoping that they have a removal spell, that's a bad place to be, I think.
Any merit to green cantrips? I was going to say Oath of Nyssa and Once Upon a Time, but not those. Adventurous Impulse, maybe?
Yeah, the problem is that Adventurous Impulse finds a type that you're not playing a lot of, which is creatures. Because I think very intelligently, you're trying to find a way to not play that many creatures to maximize your Monastery Mentor hits, then you're making a card like Adventurous Impulse much more one green mana, find a land. I would try to play some amount of adventure creatures. In this deck, you can really only play Lovestruck Beast as a card that's sort of a hidden sorcery to trigger your Monastery Mentor. It's also cheap. It also gives you multiple bodies to absorb counters or whatever. But you might want to branch out into other colors specifically to play a bunch of adventure creatures.
This was an angle that you had been interested in before, the adventure creature with Young Pyromancer. And I think you'd even drawn up like a Naya Pyromancer list at some point. All the cards that trigger Young Pyromancer also trigger Monastery Mentor. Mentor is a little more expansive in what it will accept, but it's at a much less forgiving spot on the curve. It's not really the card you want to play when you only have 3 mana available because you can't trigger it unless you have a Convoke card. But if you have 8 of the effect, then maybe they're a little more expendable. So I think there's a lot of ways you can tinker with this. To me, the green-white one is the one that actually I'm intrigued by the most. But yeah, it's a really difficult card to brew around, for sure.
Yeah, I think one of the things that they are moving towards, which I agree with, is they're playing Planeswalkers. Planeswalker is a card that triggers Mentor that does not trigger Young Pyromancer, and it also punishes you. When you're playing lots of removal that kills the Mentor, now all of a sudden you're vulnerable to these Planeswalkers. I think I would lean into that even more. I would play a bunch of Planeswalkers, and I would think about playing Heart of Kirin, which works great with Planeswalkers, also triggers your Mentor, and leans into that sort of aggressive stage. So I think if I was going to go this direction, I would maybe move away from the token thing. Token thing, it seems like it all works, but it's kind of a trap, because all your cards kind of do the same thing, where in this way you've got these multiple axes. You're attacking with Planeswalkers, you're attacking with this big flying equipment, and then you are also making a wide board to block as opposed to attack. You're making a wide board to protect your Planeswalkers, and they're just accruing value for you every turn. They're pumping out 2/2s or saplings or what have you.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Our next list comes from Kilgore Trout, who I also got to meet at Magic Fest Portland. I saw him tearing up the Pioneer, the Sunday double up, I think it was. He went 3-0. I showed up and he was down a game against a Mono Red, who used Goblin Chain Whirler to kill. Well, what did they kill? So his deck is built around the card Indomitable Creativity, which is a weird one. I had to do a double take when I first saw this card. It's X red, red, red for a sorcery. Destroy X target artifacts and or creatures. For each permanent destroy this way, its controller reveals cards from the top of his or her library until an artifact or creature card is revealed and exiles that card. And then you get to put those cards onto the battlefield. And so similar to the Possibility Storm decks that have seen some play in Pioneer, this deck uses this card to get ideally 3 Andraes Forerunners, which is kind of like a Craterhoof card that came out of Guilds of Ravnica. If you get 3 of them, they all become 13/13 and attack for 39. Am I doing the math right here? Oh, other creatures. So they all become 11/11 attack for 33, which is usually a one-shot kill. If you get 2 of them, they attack for 9 each, which is 18. And so a single shock land, or the deck packs a couple magma jets. And so that'll also finish the job for a total of 20. And so what the deck is trying to do before it gets off the Indomitable Creativity is assemble a bunch of creature tokens, just like we assembled some decks that used Thraben Inspector to power out Bolas of Citadel using, I forget what the intermediary card was.
Shape Anew.
Shape Anew. Just like our Shape Anew week used cards like Thraben Inspector or Tyler's Tracker to shape anew the tokens into a Bolas of Citadel. This deck uses cards like Hordling Outburst, or even as deep as Giant Opportunity, a card out of Eldraine, which is just a delightful magic card. 2 and a green to get 3 food tokens, or you can sack 2 foods to get a 7/7 green giant. Both of these give you a one-shot effect to get enough tokens to cast Creativity for X equals 3. And the deck also features a card out of Eldraine, Ironcrag Feat, 1 red, red, red to get 7 red mana, but you only get 1 more spell. Well, that spell would, of course, be your Indomitable Creativity with X equals 3 as early as turn 4.
Jason is very active in our Discord, and he's been iterating on this list for quite some time. I didn't understand it at first, like, why you would want to do this with Indomitable Creativity, because I was thinking of Shape Anew, like Dim was saying, which we'd explored. That's like a polymorph type card where you just want to make one token and get one exciting thing. Creativity is an X spell, so you can get multiple things, and that kind of changes the whole equation. So I've been thinking, you know, why not just play Dwarven Mind to get like your one free token and then just do it that way? But actually, X equals one on the creativity is not that good, right? It doesn't really get you anywhere. Jason specifically had said that this Endray's Forerunner kill condition is actually much more deterministic than something like just getting an Emrakul or an Ulamog. It also is more resilient than something like the Sage of Fables Locust God combo, which you can also fetch with Indomitable Creativity, but that combo will kill them, but if you draw either one of those naturally, you're kind of screwed. This deck is sort of a combination of combo ramp. If for some reason the combo's not working out, well, you're still making a lot of mana, and you can just cast these cards. If you have to, you can just cast your pigs and get them dead that way.
So when he sent this deck in, he included a specific question, which was, I would love if you could tell me how to cut interaction for splashing blue to help dig for combo pieces, like Narset, strategic planning. Also, what counterspell should be in the deck to protect the combo? Is spell pierce enough in most cases? This question was open-ended enough that I feel like I'm not stepping on any toes with this recommendation. Maybe he's already tried this, so if I'm Johnny come lately to the party, I hope he'll message us in the Discord and let us know. I would prefer a trimmer kill condition, which would just be two World Spine Worms and a Xenagos God of Revels. One of the reasons why, if you're going to add blue, I think this is useful, is if you draw your World Spine Worms and you use a discard effect, now that can be Izzet Charm, that can be Pirate's Pillage, which is a card I think I would also play. It actually shuffles them back into your deck. So your fail case of only hitting two cards, you'll always have two World Spine Worms in your deck effectively. And if they aren't given haste by Xenagos, at least you still have 30 power and it's resistant to Wrath effects. I think that's just a little more resilient. It leaves you a lot of other play. And Izzet Charm is a card that I love in these types of decks. It works as a counterspell if you needed to. It works as a search effect to find your combo piece if you needed to. It works as a removal spell early if you needed to. And it works as, like I said, a way to remove the World Spine and Worms from your hand if you happen to draw them, and they get shuffled right back into your deck. It also makes you a little more resistant to Thoughtseize. They can't Thoughtseize away, you know, if they Thoughtseize away your Darragaz, if it's in your opening hand, then you're just stuck. So I would consider maybe making the deck more of a Jeskai base. I think my creatures or my artifact sources would be four Pirate's Pillage. You get to play Teferi. That already insulates you from counterspells. And then maybe some amount of Raise the Alarms. And I would see if maybe you can make it work that way.
Are you aiming more for a critical X equals 2 off the Indomitable Creativity?
Yes. An X equals 2 would either hit a Xenagos and a World Spine Worm, which would attack for 30 trample damage, which is similar to sort of the nut draw that he's describing. Or you would hit two World Spine Worms, which isn't the best, but it would allow you to at least threaten 30 trample damage on the next turn.
So if you're building it that way, you're giving up on the possibility of hardcasting these, and probably for the same reason you would not want to play a card like Urinkrag Feet, because you only need 5 total, right? The creativity is 3 plus X equals 2.
Right, and so basically you're giving up your perfect nut draw is gone. You don't get to win. You know, he describes the perfect nut draw, and when that happens, that feels awesome, right? At the same time, you get to play Teferi to protect your combo when you're going off. And you get a little bit more search capacity. You know, as soon as you start to play blue and you're playing for Izzet Charm and getting to play, again, a card like Pirate's Pillage, it both searches for your combo and gives you combo pieces. That's very attractive to me. You can play Opt if you want to. You know, you can play some of the blue cycling cards. Sensor is a possibility. I would look to do that. If that's something you've already tried, maybe he has tried these things and found that it's worse. That'd be my feedback, is to just try it. He also mentions Shimmer of Possibility. I think that's a great card to play. Like I said, once you start to add blue, Shimmer of Possibility is a great way to filter all the big beaters that you see. All right, you know that they're in your deck. You're chucking them on the bottom, and you're trying to find one of your 4 Indomitable Creativities, basically. And that's the limiting card.
We're going to post this list. Jason has included a nice write-up, not just the best lines, but also some of his conclusions that he's found from playtesting this deck, both online and in paper events. So definitely worth a read. And I think this is one of the decks that it looks a little bit crazy, totally different from other Indomitable Creativity decks, but it does work and it's quite impressive, very stylish when it wins. I love the creativity here in both senses.
Exactly. It is indomitable. All right, so Unpronounceable submitted a list, which is a Azorius, although it's mostly blue, Narset for days is what he's calling it. This is a pioneer list, and it really seeks to exploit the interaction between Narset, Parter of Veils, one of the many powerful planeswalkers that saw print in 2019, and Day's Undoing. and then additionally the backside of Commit to Memory. So just for everyone's edification, Narset of Veils is a one blue for a planeswalker, and what we're really most interested here in is its passive ability, which is that each opponent can't draw more than one card each turn. It can minus two to look at the top four cards of your library, and you can reveal a non-creature, non-land card and put it into your hand. But that passive ability is what Unpronounceable is really interested in. So if you have Narset in play and you cast Day's Undoing, each player shuffles his or her hand and graveyard into their library and then draws seven cards. So your opponent's only going to get one card there, and you're going to get to draw the full seven. Day's Undoing's drawback is supposed to be that your opponent gets the first crack with seven. Instead, especially if you catch them with cards in their hand, it's actually like a huge discard spell slash multiple draw spell for you. Commit to Memory, which is an Amonkhet card. So the first half is a four mana instant that puts target spell or non-land permanent into its owner's library second from the top. But Memory has this very cool interaction with Narset, because each player again shuffles his or her hand in the graveyard into their library, and then they draw seven new cards. So you can like EOT commit something into their library to protect Narset, let's say, and then if you have six mana you can Memory, and all of a sudden, you know, you're getting like a 10 for one or something at times.
Yeah, and this deck actually features a couple interactions with Teferi, Time Raveler, or Quicken, which lets you cast Day's Undoing or Memory on your opponent's turn, which means that instead of them getting to have two cards as they enter their main phase, they'll actually wind up with zero cards, and you'll get to take your turn unimpeded and untap with seven cards in hand.
It feels like a lifetime ago, but Narset and Day's Undoing was briefly a deck of interests a lot of people were trying to iterate on to some success. Now, the list that Unpronounceable has sent us is for the Pioneer format, but do you guys feel like there's any lessons that we can take away from the modern build of that deck, where it was leading more into free spells like Snapback, Force of Negation, Disrupting Shoal, even cards you can pitch because you're getting the best value out of Day's Undoing when you've got an empty hand and they've still got stuff in their hand?
Yeah, so I think the main lesson is you need a way to play to the board, right? You have these engines that are functioning like draw tens, you know, or your opponent's discarding three and you're drawing six or something. That means once that kind of effect resolves, as long as you don't die, you're likely to win, right? You just have to play the cards from your hand. The way that Modern List did this was to play these free spells. One of the things that makes me nervous about this list is how little cheap interaction we have. I was brewing around this card right when Pioneer was released, and I was playing Sultai because black has so much of the best removal. Maybe you'd want to play Esper here. The appeal of Oko is gone, and the mana generation of the Goose is no longer a consistent source of mana, so the green is a little less attractive. But being able to play Fatal Push, for instance, cheap ways to protect Narset, which is a key card you need to have in play. I mean, people forget, okay, these Planeswalkers are busted, and we all like to complain about them, but you can always just attack them, and there's not a lot of ways in this deck to stop a two mana or a second turn like five power creature from just killing Narset. So I'd want either cheaper white ways to do that, or I'd want to add another color that will allow me to protect my Narset and Teferi.
Yeah, I agree with Dave that I think like maybe even just a couple Supreme Verdicts would go a long way. The list features two Settle the Wreckages and three Engulf the Shores, but both of those are kind of like a little bit tricky to really get max value out of, whereas like a Supreme Verdict is just a clean way to get the same thing. I would still be concerned about interacting with Planeswalkers. If they resolve a strong Planeswalker, you can Day's Undoing all you want, but you still might have trouble clearing it unless you have, I guess this list features a couple Blink of an Eye.
What intrigues me here is the bounce angle of the deck, the Blink of an Eye, the Unexplained Disappearance, and Thing in the Ice, and Engulf the Shores. Now, we talked last week about the card Gear Up or Orrery. So far, our results have not been too promising with that, but one of the angles that we talked about and haven't quite fully embraced is Gear Up or Orrery will reward you heavily if you're empty-handed and they still have cards in their hand. So it's actually quite similar to a card like Day's Undoing in terms of the incentives. Like, you want to spend all your resources as fast as you can and keep them choked on stuff they're trying to cast. Narset interacts favorably with the Orrery, so even if for some reason they are empty-handed, they still can't draw multiple cards with Narset in play, and you could just lean harder into more cheap bounce. Like, there's the card Void Snare is a one mana card that can bounce any permanent. Brazen Borrower is one that if you, let's say you had that instead of Blink of an Eye, you can fire that off. It just chills in the adventure zone so that, you know, if you do refill hands later, you're not at seven cards, you're at eight or nine cards. You still have these borrowers left over.
Yeah, I actually really like Brazen Borrower because this list is currently geared around running some Mutavaults and Thing in the Ices to actually win the game. If you add Brazen Borrower over Blink of an Eye, you can rely on the 3-1 creature half instead of the Mutavaults, which frees up your land slot to both A, have more reliable Engulf the Shores, or just even casting Supreme Verdict on a curve, and also gives you land slots to add maybe a Gyre's Reach Sanitarium or two.
Gotta have a Gyre's Reach Sanitarium. Sanitarium in here. That card is so good. If people aren't familiar with the interaction, if you have a Narset in play, you can activate it during your opponent's upkeep. If they have no cards in hand, both players draw and discard, so they draw and discard. They stay at zero cards. And Narset does not allow them to draw another card for their draw. So it gives you a hard lock after you've sort of activated your Day's Undoing plan. I agree exactly with what Damon's saying. I don't think you need Mutavaults to win the game. First of all, your opponent's just going to rage concede. You don't have to worry about doing lethal damage. But once you have them down to zero cards and you just have that hard lock, that's all you really need to show them. I mean, one or two Brazen Borrowers or a Thing in the Ice or whatever. I mean, that'll get the job done in due time.
Yeah, so a lot of cards that playing in the similar space here and a lot of ways to tweak out both the spells and the lands. Each one has sort of cascading implications for how certain cards play, how you're going to end the game, and you know how stable your mana base is, how strong your end game is, how consistent your earlier interaction is. I like the take on this, and I think there's a lot of different ways to tweak this out. Definitely something powerful happening here for sure in this build.
Up next, we have a deck titled Angel Fires East North East by Paimon from our Discord. The way I would describe this deck is as a Boros Fires of Invention deck featuring a heavy angel package involving cards like Bishop of Wings along with Resplendent Angel and Archangel of Thune, and then a couple Lyra Dawnbringers and Fireman Avenger, which is one from Return to Ravnica, and it casts a Lightning Helix if you attack with at least two other creatures. I'm not really sure what the East Northeast thing was referencing. Sorry. You have to fill us in on Discord at some point. But yeah, and then it features a couple of Deafening Clarions to sweep away whatever your opponent's doing, along with Bone Crusher Giants. And an interesting choice of main deck Fiendslayer Paladins.
The card here that you don't see that often is Bishop of Wings. White for a 1/4. Whenever an angel enters the battlefield under your control, you gain 4 life. Whenever an angel you control dies, create a 1/1 spirit creature token with flying. That second ability I think is not that interesting, but the first ability, gaining 4 life, can be worth nothing or it can be worth quite a lot. Resplendent Angel is the one that will really pay you off for that. If you've gained 5 life during your turn, on your end step you will get another angel token. It has the ability to pump itself for 6 mana and get the lifelink and trigger itself, but that's not very efficient. What you really want is to be gaining that life more efficiently from other cards, like the Bishop of Wings, like Lyra Dawnbringer, or like Archangel of Thune. Do you think that Bishop of Wings is a card that can anchor a strategy like this?
Yeah, I actually think this card is really powerful. It's quite resistant to a lot of red-based removal. We're seeing a ton more red decks after a series of bannings here in Pioneer. It also means you can play a lot less interaction because you're going to just naturally win races if you're gaining 4 life incidentally every turn. And if you get to activate the angel, if anyone's ever done this, you get another 4 life with the angel that it makes. It sets up this cascading series where you basically can't lose. It also, I think, very notably, has 2 white pips, and I would consider maybe moving away from most of these red cards except for Cavalier Flame and trying to think about using some amount of Nykthos in the deck. And I would also strongly consider putting just a few more cheap cards in there. I had experimented with a mono white Angels build where I was playing like 4 Thraben Inspector and 4 Knight of the White Orchid at the bottom, and then a 4 drop that I would strongly consider is both Gisela the Broken Blade and Archangel of Ties. Archangel of Ties is a card that nobody ever talks about. It's both an angel, which is important to this deck, obviously. It has 3 white pips, which is important if you're going to play Nykthos. And it has text that people don't realize how annoying it is until they have to pay the cost to attack you. You have this 3/5. It's resistant to Glorybringer, let's say. It's resistant to Chandra. It's resistant to Abrupt Decay. And for all the creatures they want to attack you with, they have to pay a mana. So against Gruul or some of these other lists where you nominally have some of these like sweeping effects in play, this just shuts their whole deck down. They really have a hard time interacting with it.
I should mention for the listeners that we had asked the brewers to not use any Theros cards because those are not available yet. But as Dave is saying, the devotion themes here are potentially very interesting. We talked about Helia, God of the Sun, as a devotion payoff that also operates in the life gain space. Archangel of Tithes provides 3 white pips for Nykthos or whatever else you want to do with your devotion.
A cool interaction that he kind of has built in here is Archangel of Thune with Bishop of Wings in play. So Archangel of Thune comes into play, Bishop of Wings triggers, and all your creatures get +1/+1. If you are getting to attack with an angel that has lifelink, or if you have another way to gain life, that'll give you your 5 for the turn, let's say, if you have Resplendent Angel. Then you'll get another angel at end of turn, gain 4 life, and trigger Archangel again. So it's those sort of cascading effects that are really interesting. Also, you can imagine on a turn 5 getting to play with a Fires in Play, getting to play Cavalier of Flame into Archangel of Thune, give them both haste. Archangel of Thune is going to hit for 4 and buff all your creatures in play. Those kind of plays are very powerful in the midrange, and I just get nervous that we are going to hit our 5th land on time. This list is only playing 24 lands, so that's one of the reasons why cards like Thraben Inspector or Knight of the White Orchid are interesting to me. Your mana is important. Knight of the White Orchid is a fixing element too. It finds your dual lands for you. Thraben Inspector is a card that absorbs these tokens from Archangel of Thune. You know, all of a sudden it becomes a reasonable blocker. And you have the mana to sack the clues once you have the fire in play. So my experience playing with fires is you really want to make sure you hit your 4th land on time and your 5th land on time. So I would maybe play a 25th land, and I would add, maybe you don't want to play the full playset of either of those, but I would at least think about playing cards that help you kind of smooth out your draws. Sometimes you're going to have 2 lands in hand and you're going to have to keep it because you've got other cards that are good, and you're going to want to make sure you can transition into your fires on 4 for sure.
Yeah, I definitely agree that the deck's curve is perhaps a little bit high with only 4 Bishop of Wings and 4 Bone Crusher in the 2 mana plays.
So this is a list that Paimon's been working on for a while. I know he's already got at least 1-4-1 with this in Magic Online Leagues and has continued to iterate on it. The Angel package is quite nice, and I really like the way that there's all these fires mana sinks just woven throughout the deck at all different spots. I mean, we already talked about Resplendent Angel, Cavalier of Flame is here. Little cards like Dawn of Hope, there's a Castle Ardenvale or two in the land-based adventure creatures. So at first glance, it might not be obvious that there's any synergy at all between Fires of Invention and this Angel Life Gain theme, but when you look at the actual cards that go into the deck, you can see how they accompany each other quite nicely to round out with multiple angels of attack and more explosive sequences.
I really like the idea of being able to attack with Fire Main Angel the turn you play it. I would be interested to hear how often that is getting to trigger. Now, I think one of the combos kind of built in here is with 5 lands in play and a Fires, you can play a Cavalier and a Fire Main Avenger. So all of a sudden you can attack and you get to cast your free Lightning Helix. If that's coming up a lot, maybe you want more of them. And if you're finding that, you know, this is a deck that each individual creature is so powerful, we're not really worried about attacking with 3 cards. Anytime we do that, we're kind of winning. Then you maybe want 0. So I'm wondering if Firemane Avenger is a card you want more of or less of. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, Paimon is probably finding out as they are iterating on some of these numbers.
Yeah. To push on a point that Dave was making earlier, one of the beautiful things about Cavalier of Flame is it has this ETB trigger where you get to discard cards and draw new cards. And so if you flood out with your Fires draw, but you hit your 5th land draw, have a Fires and a Cavalier, then all of a sudden you can dump the extra lands you have and try to find more gas. And so that kind of lets you build a deck with a slightly heavier land mana base than you would otherwise want.
Now, the next list is probably the list with the longest history of any deck that was submitted. This deck is Esper Mythseize by Spot Red, longtime listener of the cast, and also somewhat of a famous brewer in the sense that Spot Red has been working on this Mythseize deck for years. I'm going to post a deck list where Spot Red has compiled an extremely extensive guide, not only to the current build, but to like 4 years worth of iteration on this deck. Basically, the entire mission of this deck is to maximize the card Myth Realized. Enchantment for a single white. Whenever you cast a non-creature spell, put a lower counter on Myth Realized. So it's basically a prowess trigger. But instead of getting +1/+1 until end of turn, you actually get a lower counter, which then converts to power and toughness when you turn the Myth Realized into a creature. So how do you do that? Well, you pay 1 white mana, and until end of turn, Myth Realized becomes a monk avatar creature with the ability its power and toughness is equal to the number of lower counters on Myth Realized. So you play it on 1, it grows over time by adding these lower counters whenever you cast non-creature spells, whenever you trigger prowess, and then when the time is right, you can activate it for 1 white. It also has the ability, 2 and a white, to just add another lower counter to it without having to cast a spell. So whenever you have free mana available, you can start pumping up your Myth. I can't quite do justice in one quick go, but before we dive into the actual build, like, what do you guys think of that card specifically, and how would you build a Myth Realized deck? Because Spot Red has actually tried it all. What do you guys think of Myth Realized as a card, as a build around?
I love Myth Realized. It's a card I've tooled around with in casual a lot. I know you've mentioned that you're like, oh man, there's this guy. I mean, he's been iterating on this sweet Myth Realized deck in Modern for so long. I love that someone else out there is being inspired by it. It is an enchantment, like we said. That's really important in the world of Oko. There are, unfortunately, other cards that people can main deck that can kind of get you. I'm thinking of 3-mana Teferi. I'm thinking of Cryptic Command. I'm thinking of Archmage's Charm after you fire it up. So you need to be conscious of that, and it looks like he has built in a lot of protection sort of as he, you know, is trading 1-for-1 throughout the game to make sure that when it's time for Myth Realized to party, it's going to do so responsibly.
Yeah, Dan, the one place I've seen Myth Realized used before is in some Legacy Standstill decks, which always seemed like a pretty cool type of build to run.
How does it work with Standstill, and what is Standstill?
Yeah, so Standstill is a wild Magic card. It's one in a blue, and it's an enchantment, and it just sits there, and it reads, whenever a player casts a spell, sacrifice Standstill, and everybody else gets to draw three cards. And so all of a sudden, if your opponent plays a Standstill and you're looking and you're not ahead on board immediately, the game just goes into a weird, weird mode where if you just cast anything, they get to draw three cards, which is very, very powerful, puts them super far ahead usually. And so frequently the deck that runs Standstill wants to play cards like Mishra's Factory or Mutavault type cards. Likewise, Myth Realized can function in that role where it comes down on one, and then if both players are sitting there with a Standstill out, you can dump lore counters in and get aggressive.
So the way that this deck is built right now is an Esper deck built around as many cheap interactive pieces as you can reasonably fit in a main deck. So Fatal Push, there's Thoughtseize, there's Inquisition of Kozilek. So it's basically, that's the black core. There's Tasker the Golden Fang as well. There's Murderous Rider, Drown of the Lock, Arkham's Astrolabe, which is very important to kind of keep the cards flowing while also fixing your mana so that you have the ability to splash. So you don't have to just play black-white with a light blue splash, but you can even go into green for Oko, Thief of Crowns. Spot Red has correctly identified that decks just tend to improve in Modern when you add Oko to them. In some sense, it is a collection of like the most efficient interactive pieces that you can surround your card with, which then raises the question for me, like, well, why Myth Realized? Like, what is that card in particular doing for a shell like this that has these surrounding interactive pieces? And the answers, I think, Dave, you've already kind of touched on, that Myth Realized, by virtue of being an enchantment, tends to dodge most of the commonly played removal. It's basically just Teferi, Time Raveler bouncing it. That's kind of the worst thing that could happen to it when it's not active. And then you don't have to activate it until the coast is clear. On top of that, it just seems like spot removal is at an all-time low in Modern. You just don't see many paths and pushes being thrown around. So in that sense, I'm not even sure that you would need this many discard pieces for the purpose of protecting the Myth. Now, they're maybe good for other reasons, but I think the time has come maybe where you can just build a Myth Realized deck that doesn't need to protect the Myth. They kind of protect themselves.
Yeah, one of the things that makes me nervous is right now, black seems like a really tough color to run because of the ultimate blue elemental blast that they chose to print this year. When you're relying on both blue and black as your ways to interact, I just think you're really vulnerable to, you know, a one green mana instant that counters that ability and draws a card. We have a blue-black counterspell, we have black discard, we have black removal. So I'm wondering if you can maybe play a Bant color or something in a Bant in black or a Salta, you know. Adding this extra color, I'm not sure is actually worth it when the interaction is so good against specifically blue and black.
At the very least, the list features three Teferi, Time Raveler, which is pretty good against Veil of Summer.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Again, there's no Theros cards in this list, but Theros as an enchantment set raises the possibility that there is something to do with the fact that Myth Realized is an enchantment as well. I mentioned Heliod Sun Crowned can put its +1/+1 counters. While that is not a lore counter, it functionally does the same thing of increasing the power of Myth Realized when you do activate it. So if for some reason you had a deck that was built around enchantments and life gain triggers, like with the new Daxos Demigod or something, Myth Realized can receive the counters from Heliod, or it could just function with whatever other enchantment adjacent cards you might want to play. It is a very efficient card at just one white that if you're trying to find useful enchantments for one mana, this is potentially one of the best ones if you do the work to optimize it.
I'm actually really curious about playing this card in Pioneer, and I would like a Spot Red to let us know if they have tried it there. I'm looking at the Tapped Out page, and he correctly points out that one of the strengths is you get to play this powerful creature that is not vulnerable to Wrath. That makes me really interested in playing a deck that's like 4 Myth Realized, 4 Heart of Kirin, 4 Gideon Blackblade, 4 Teferi Time Raveler. So now we've got all these threats. None of them are creatures. They all trigger Myth Realized, and we can play a full set of Wrath if we want on top of that, that again, triggers our Myth Realized, with Teferi protecting it on our turn when we make it a creature. That kind of shell is really interesting to me, and he was saying on his Tapped Out thing again, one of the only weaknesses is that you can get tempoed out. Well, Gideon Blackblade giving lifelink to Heart of Kirin or a Myth Realized is a way to steal back all that tempo after you cast your Wrath of God. That shell is really intriguing to me, and I'm wondering if Spot Red has tried it at all. So yeah, please let us know.
Oh, I can tell you the answer to that actually, because Spot Red has actually posted an updated build for Pioneer in our Discord. It does use some Theros cards, so he didn't submit it for this segment.
Oh, okay.
Let me tell you a little bit about that while we're on the subject, because it leans into some of the interactions you're describing. That build that Spot Red has proposed for the Pioneer version does lean into Verdix. He's got three of them main deck. He's actually identified the card Dovin's Acuity, draft all-star from Ravnica Allegiance. One blue-white enchantment, when Dovin's Acuity enters the battlefield, you gain two life and draw a card, and then you can return Dovin's Acuity to your hand to trigger it multiple times. The condition for that is casting an instant spell during your main phase. So you need to have instants that you're fine to cast at any time, even on your own turn. So cards like Opt, Fatal Push, those are instants that, you know, if you have to cast on your own turn, it's not a disaster. You're not losing a ton. And on top of that, Cling to Dust, which we talked about last week, this new sort of cremate with Escape as a 4-of to both trigger the Dovin's Acuity to be a cantrip to help fuel the Mithrealized, and also to perhaps fight against these Escape cards that might be coming down the pipeline. So this is a really interesting build as well. I'll also just post that link because I think it's an interesting direction. But it goes to show how open-ended Mithrealized is. And if you have time and interested, you should definitely read through everything that Spot Red has written on this in his Tapped Out page. We're running short on time. We unfortunately are not able to get through all the decks that were sent in, but we are going to post everything that was submitted to us in the show notes. So we've already talked about, I think, about 7 or 8 lists. There are even more in the show notes with some really interesting decks. So there's like a mono green Ponza from Ender's Genocide. There's a Arclight Dredge, a blue Arclight Phoenix deck that uses the card Drown Secrets to mill yourself and hit your Creeping Chills, kind of porting that from Standard into Pioneer. That's from Jonathan Walsh. Unpronounceable had a couple interesting brews. One using Quasi-Duplicate with Agent of Treachery to sort of steal all the permanents. Another one using Morophon the Boundless plus Tron mana and Slivers. That kind of says it all. It's actually a really sweet deck. Much more going on in the brewing side. We'll just post those lists. I encourage everyone to take a look at them and let us know what you think about these builds. That being said, thanks to everyone who has submitted for this segment. This is our first time doing this brew review session, so if you like this kind of content, be sure to let us know so we can do it more often. Or if you feel like, yeah, whatever, let us know too. That's all very helpful. Thanks very much to everyone who sent in their list. If you would like to get in on this action, you can join our Patreon. Patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is one of the many privileges you can get, is have your deck reviewed.
I'm going to try to tweak some of these lists out and maybe jump in the queues with a couple of them. There's some interesting ideas here. You know, like I said, maybe you can quibble on some of the card choices, but just something that sparks an idea. You know, they used to say about Jimi Hendrix, someone would accidentally drop a guitar on stage and he would think that was cool and he'd write a song around it. So you can find ideas in lists that maybe you'd never play yourself, but there's a 2 or 3 card in action there you never thought of, and that kind of stuff just kind of inspires me as a deck builder. And there's lots of great ideas in a lot of these lists that I'm already excited to start jotting down notes about, you know, this card or that card. So
absolutely, yeah. So we might be back next week with our testing reports on these decks as well. Who knows where the week's going to take us. So we're going to call it at that for this week. We'll be back next week with our follow-up to Gear Priori along with a new card. All right, well, that'll do it for this show. Take care, gentlemen.
Take care.
See ya.
That'll do it for this edition of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. You can find all of the deck lists from today's show in the episode description of your podcast player. Faithless Brewing is a listener-supported show. If you like what you heard and would like to contribute directly, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. All patrons get access to our Discord channel and other cool rewards. You can also find us on Twitter at faithlessmtg, email us faithlessbrewing@gmail.com, or our homepage faithlessbrewing.podbean.com. We rely on brewers like you to help us improve the show and bring you better content. So give us a follow, tell a friend, and we will see you next week.